Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Thank you for spending your time with us this weekend. It is a spooky, stormy night here in the desert. Rain's been falling on our parched valleys. Flash flood warnings have been issued. Dark clouds have dominated our skies most of the day. Lightning been flashing. And to all of that, I say, perfect, perfect weather for a coast-to-coast night. And man, for several weeks now, I've been kind of mentally counting down the days for this Sunday to arrive because of the guests we have on tap for tonight and the subject matter we're going to cover. I put on a pot of Kauaian pea berry, but don't think I need the caffeine to be jazzed for this one. You know, we've all seen the Spielberg masterpiece, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Doesn't matter if you're interested in UFOs or ETs or not. That is one terrific movie, and it was a huge hit, commercially and critically. And if you've seen the film, you remember the character of Claude Lacombe, a French scientist who was in charge of the scientific team investigating an escalating series of bizarre UFO encounters all over the world. Toward the end of the film, Lacombe, played by the late director Francois Truffaut, is talking to Roy Neary. He's the main protagonist, played by Richard Dreyfuss, and he asks, "Monsieur Neary, what do you want?" And Neary replies, "I just want to know that it's really happening." And so would we all. The character Lacombe was modeled after a real-life scientist, also French, a guy who's been studying the UFO mystery for decades. I've made no secret of the fact that I consider Jacques Vallée to be the most important person to ever write about UFOs, the deepest thinker, a tireless champion for a scientific study of this baffling phenomenon, and one who hasn't been afraid to go against the grain, not only daring to pursue a topic that's considered too fringy and off-limits by most mainstream scientists, but also challenging the bedrock paradigms of the UFO movement itself. If you consider yourself to be a serious student of this mystery, Vallée's books on the topic are what I would call mandatory reading. Taken together, they are not only a unique history of the modern ufology movement, its cases and its characters, but also those books kind of set the parameters for the larger debate. What does this mean? What evidence do we have? How can we find out more? And as I've said on this program previously, Jacques Vallée is the guy who stood up and said to the UFO world, you know, maybe these visitors are not ETs after all, or not only ETs. Maybe there's something else. Maybe this mystery goes far beyond just nuts and bolts spaceships. Maybe they live here. Maybe they've always lived here, but under different names or guises. They didn't just pop into the neighborhood starting in 1947. He's taken a lot of grief from ufologists, from other scientists, from the debunkers, of course, and from media. But he continues to carve his own path and to pull ufology kicking and screaming toward respectability. I'd say the subject probably still has a ways to go before it's quite respectable, but it's the effort that counts. Tonight, Claude Lacombe jumps off the silver screen, makes the transition from fictional Hollywood character to living, breathing, flesh and blood author and scientist Jacques Vallée, who is here with us tonight to, I think, make some news and some noise. He will speak publicly for the first time anywhere about his vision for a bold new chapter in UFO research, a proposal I think that could change the direction for ufology and perhaps even make it respectable enough for other scientists to take a stab at it. I know what you're thinking, scientists studying UFO cases and evidence. Well, that's just crazy talk. Well, maybe not. In just a few minutes, Dr. Jacques Vallée will be here with us to lay it on the line, tell us what he has in mind. And we'll also save some time to get his take on different aspects of the UFO ET interdimensional mysteries that we discuss each night on this program. But there's more. One of the landmark projects in Vallée's career was an effort to get the United Nations involved in a scientific study of UFOs. I'll tell you, the skullduggery involved in that little chapter, the political intrigue and dirty tricks that were pulled, they could be a Spielberg movie all their own. The journalist who helped to organize that United Nations platform for UFOs and who worked with Dr. Vallee and Alan Hynek, Stan Friedman, and others way back in the 70s is journalist Lee Spiegel. He's now working with the Huffington Post, but still very active in this arena. And he will share his reactions to the proposals that Jacques is going to unveil tonight, tell us about the United Nations episode, and also share with us his sense of where the subject might be headed. Lee Spiegel will be here in the second half of the program tonight. So, yeah, I'm jazzed. A quick thank you to the folks at MUFON. They put on one heck of an international symposium last weekend. Thanks to the folks in the Philadelphia and New Jersey areas for graciously hosting what turned out to be, I think, a wildly successful get-together. I had the pleasure of being one of the speakers. Lee Spiegel was also a highlight. Linda Howe, James Fox. I saw filmmaker Jeremy Corbell there, along with other journalists who recorded interviews with the speakers and other witnesses. Good stuff. Primary focus and theme this year was how the media handles the UFO topic. I think the symposium proceedings are already out in the book form if you're interested. On the Coast website, several items of interest culled from recent news reports by webmaster Tim Binall and yours truly, articles listed under the heading Naps News, some of them directly related to our interviews this evening, others just a bit weird and offbeat, kind of like me. The piece about women in black is a good one. And we have some photos of our guests tonight taken back in the day when we were all a bit younger. I think you'll get a kick out of seeing them. So, folks, bring in the dog, put out the cat, crank up the coffee pot, wiggle into those jammies, and let's get ready to rumble because this is going to be a good one. In a moment, Jacques Vallee. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Jacques Vallee has led an amazing life, several lives, rolled into one. He was an astronomer at the Paris Observatory in the early 60s, where he witnessed the destruction of records related to the tracking of unknown objects in space. UFOs. He asked about it, and it hooked him. He came to the U.S., got his Ph.D. in computer science at Northwestern University, where he became a close friend and colleague with Dr. J. Allen Hynek, widely regarded as the father of American ufology, who at the time was a consultant to the Air Force's infamous Project Blue Book. Vallee's books, The UFO Enigma, Challenge to Science, Anatomy of a Phenomena, Passport to Magonia, Messengers of Deception, and several others are considered the gold standard of UFO research and are the heart and soul of my UFO library, no matter how big it gets. He is here tonight to hopefully re-energize the scientific study of UFOs and finally tackle the really big questions that have eluded us for so long. Jacques, great to have you back.
Thank you, George. It's always exciting to be on your show, and tonight I think we have a chance to report on some progress for a change, so that's even more exciting.
Well, let's jump right into it. You know, it seems like nothing stays a secret for very long in ufology. People blab and yammer and spill the beans, but you attended a large and serious gathering of some of the best scientists in the world, and I haven't seen one peep about it anywhere. What, if anything, can you tell us about that gathering?
Well, it was not secret. It was just, you know, the way science, I think, should be done. It was quiet and sober and discreet. There was no public invited, but the French CNES, which is the French NASA, which is a major space agency, decided to hold a conference, a two-day workshop on UFOs. They don't call them UFOs; they call them UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, because that's what they are. But everybody knows, what we're talking about. And there were 30 presentations by people from seven countries who were, by invitation only. And there were about 100 participants who came from all over. And many of them were active UFO researchers. And this was remarkable, first given the history of French science. French scientists have, just like here, have been hostile to spending money on UFO research, but that's changing. And it's changing because there is a new generation of scientists who understand, are more relaxed about the issues, and are certainly aware that the world is not as simple as we thought it was 50 years ago.
That is remarkable. Now, you wrote a paper. I don't think we can talk about it. I think there are some conditions on it, but can we at least get into the general parameters? And is this paper sort of consistent with what the other speakers were also proposing?
Yes. My paper is, I mean, all the papers are on embargo until they can be all published together. So it's more of an editing delay. I mean, there's no secrecy involved. The paper will not be changed or anything. It would not be courteous on my part to publish it before the CNES publishes it. They will publish all the papers together.
Understood.
In a few months, and that involves translation and so on. The conference was in French and English. There were people from Russia, from Italy, from Norway, from Estonia, from the UK, from Belgium, and so on. And it was really a historic opportunity, not only to hear other contributions, but also, of course, to talk apart from the main sessions, to talk privately with people who had been doing this kind of research. Now, the scope was very wide, as it should be when you bring scientists together. It was clear that not everybody thought that this phenomena indicated a particular a particular origin or a particular nature. The main topic was, and you have to put it in context, the CNES alone among all the major space agencies has had a research program on this topic since 1975. That was set up by Dr. Claude Poher, who is a French physicist and astronomer, who convinced the French Minister of Research at the time to create a small project to study observations reported to the government. What they did was very clever. Since they were an official agency, they signed agreements with the major other agencies like the local police, the gendarmerie, the Air Force, and so on, to gather observations that were unidentified. And then they set up a process to try to identify them. And as you know, most of the reports from the public can't be identified. Nobody challenges that. I mean, a large proportion of all the UFO reports turn out to be explainable things, sometimes very unusual things, but explainable when you take the trouble to do some research and to meet the people and to investigate the case. That group within CNES has 22% of all the cases unexplained. And this is, they've published that. So there is obviously, a residue of cases that have resisted physical explanation. And that's what the conference was all about. The question was, how do you gather cases? How do you research them? How do you interview witnesses? How do you assemble databases, and what can you do with the data? So I came away realizing again that the subject looks very different when you look at it outside, away from the United States. I mean, here, we suffer from a clash of ideologies. People jump to conclusions. Oh, they must be ETs from here. No, no, they are ETs from there. No, it's something else. No, it's a devil. No, it's angels. And people jump to all kinds of conclusions based on ideology, and nobody is really taking a good long look at the data. Now, this was different. All the people there were were scientists or they were people from the military. There were people in the audience from the office of the Prime Minister of France. So this was a very serious gathering.
So it's fertile ground for discussion, but just doesn't have quite as many weeds as sometimes that we have gatherings here, where there's so many political agendas, personal agendas, infighting, backbiting, backstabbing, all kinds of crap going on. You just didn't have that.
No, we were among colleagues with different opinions, which is the way science is done. You want all the opinions to be represented, and you want people to be free to express their opinions.
You have made the point that there's a heck of a lot of UFO case information out there, both in, for example, Battelle had studied some of the government files. There are private organizations, the civilian organizations, CUFOs and MUFON, that have their own vast filing systems. But there should be some kind of a way, I think, is what you're proposing, to sort of tie them all together. I guess my question is it still possible to, well, we'll talk about your idea first and then get into the larger question of, is it possible to resolve these mysteries by studying cases?
The specific presentation that I made had to do with strategy. You know, what is there a strategy for research? And my domain of, you know, expertise, if you want to call it that, you know, I'm not a physical expert. I'm certainly not a psychological expert. What I know about is information science, and that's what I've tried to apply consistently to this problem. Now, as you mentioned, the first catalog of cases was really done by the Battelle Memorial Institute in the early 50s for the U.S. Air Force. And this was, they took the very early observations that had been sent to the Air Force and compiled the first catalog for Project Blue Book that Hynek and I continued in the 60s. When I immigrated to the U.S. in 1962, I brought the European files of UFOs that I had been researching with my wife and merged that with the American data that Dr. Hynek had collected. And that gave us really the first organized catalog that was really independent of the Air Force. We redid the statistics of the Air Force. We found that their statistics were very biased, very misleading, that there was at least 25% or 30% unexplained in the Blue Book files. So today we laugh at Blue Book because it was mostly, you know, a public relations job on behalf of the Air Force. But actually, there was a lot of very valuable data in there. They just didn't have the personnel or the motivation to exploit it and to study it. But when we did, we found that there was a lot that was unexplained. Now, there was an independent group at the time called NICAP that started in the mid-50s and developed its own files. And now MUFON has a collection system which is active, and they are continuing, you know, in that gathering data and building these databases. There have been many other efforts. In the early days of the Condon study at the University of Colorado, which was funded by the Air Force and was also, you know, a whitewash job, but there were serious people there, including Dr. Saunders, who started a catalog called UFOCAT. And UFOCAT was started with the files that I turned over to him. And when Dr. Hynek and I visited the Colorado study, and that continued, Dr. Saunders continued under the aegis of QFOS, and has catalog is available. Now, in France, very early, there were similar studies. Dr. Claude Poher built a catalog. There was one before that, started by several amateurs. And then the GEPAN, which was a CNES project, in the mid-60s and 70s, built a very interesting catalogue, very thorough, based on official reports from the French public to the gendarmerie. So these are very, you know, the data is captured in a formal, official way, and that catalogue now has about 6,000 very detailed cases and is continuing, and I've been in touch with the my colleagues, you know, who are working on it.
Jacques, we need to take a break. When we come back, I want you to describe how to sort of coordinate all these different UFO databases and then take it to the next level. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. We're talking with Dr. Jacques Vallée, one of the pioneers of modern ufology, in my estimation, the most important guy to ever write about it. And he's just unveiled news about a conference that was held quietly in Europe to discuss a new direction for ufology. When we come back, some ideas from Dr. Vallée about where this could lead and the kind of questions it could answer. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jacques Vallée, before the break, you were telling me about these various databases with thousands of UFO cases kept in different places around the world. Is it your proposal to somehow tie them together or build a master database or a whole new construct?
So in about 15 years ago, I designed a data warehouse which would hold a number of databases, merging them together because they come from different directions and different demographies and so on, may not be a good idea initially. And you may want to keep them apart simply to do specific statistical studies before you can get the complete picture. I designed a data warehouse called Capella, and we implemented it with Mr. Bigelow, with Robert Bigelow in Las Vegas, under the National Institute for Discovery Science. And warehouse has grown, and I'm now taking it to the next level based on conversations I've had with other experts in databases and with UFO researchers, especially after this conference in Paris. We had missed a number of things that the databases did not capture, and I think it's important to reintroduce it. Also, at the meeting in Paris, Dr. Haynes was there. We were the only two Americans there presenting papers, and Dr. Richard Haynes, as you know, is retired. He's a retired NASA scientist. He and his team have been building a very interesting database of pilot reports from all over the world. Also interesting is a database of ancient UFO cases built by Chris Arbeck and his group called Magoniacs on the web, and I've been actively working with him. So there are all these efforts going on, usually outside of major UFO organizations. A lot of it is done by single scientists or single researchers, sometimes with a small team augmented over the internet. Now, you know, the question is, what do you do after you have a big database? I mean, there are probably about 200,000 well-documented cases if you take all the information from around the world, including Russia, including Australia, including England, and so on. But there are a number of pitfalls there. The first pitfall is that the data is so diverse that if you give me a hypothesis, for example, that this is all done by ETs, we can prove the hypothesis, provided you let me select the data.
Right.
So, if you don't take the whole thing as a big universe of data and really study it in depth, you can be led astray. You can think that you're proving your hypothesis when, in fact, you're only proving a local hypothesis, but you could find data that would prove exactly the opposite. The other problem with that people, I think, have not realized is that the data is useless without the people who understand the data. When I was in France, I took some time after the conference with two friends of mine to research a very exceptional UFO case that had not been reported in the literature, where we had, for the first time, we had access to one of the primary witnesses. And the three of us have known each other for 20 years. We've researched other cases together. We know what questions to ask. We know the environment. We know the terrain. We know the background of the people and so on. I think without that, the data would just be, you know, three lines in somebody's catalog, and it's meaningless. So the problem is not only to gather good databases and do statistics, because the statistics can be misleading if you don't understand the nature of the questions.
Yeah, it's a tremendous learning curve to be able to figure stuff out, to weed out some obvious explanations. It takes a long time to learn this stuff. That's why I'm wondering, even let's say you can somehow incorporate good database like NIDS or like MUFON, you know, who've sort of tried to do their homework and include only good cases, but there has to be some kind of way to, I guess, grade the cases. Isn't there sort of a universal standard so you can include only the best stuff, or do you need the bad stuff as well?
Well, the other question is, we don't necessarily know what the good stuff and the bad stuff are.
Yeah.
You know, the way I put it at the conference is that ufology has no ontology. In other words, you know, if it was a catalog of you know, all the transmissions that General Motors has ever built, you know, I would have to be a really bad programmer if I couldn't give you a good database that would answer all your questions, because everybody knows what, you know, what a Chevy transmission looks like. Here, we don't know what a UFO looks like. People say, well, you know, it's a disk in the sky. Well, yeah, it's a disk, but what if it's a sphere? Well, a sphere can look like a disk. Well, what if it's a cigar? What if it's a small light, 2 feet in diameter, that expands into something else? We don't know what we should be looking for. So that's a very different challenge. It's unstructured data. Now, there is a lot of unstructured data, and there is special software that can deal with that, but we have to invent some software structures. And that was, to me, that was the most important part of the conference, was I had a chance to compare notes with software experts from CNES who are working on their UFO data and are discovering some very, very interesting things. And the question is, what are the patterns? It's not just, you know, can you sort out the good cases from the bad cases, but is the phenomenon evolving? Is it going towards, you know, a particular discontinuity of its own? And those are the very important questions we were able to start discussing.
You've made the point before that, you know, the really big questions, we don't have answers to them. I'm sure that there are times when you think back to young Jacques there in 1961 who gets hooked on the UFO topic, and you think, well, my gosh, if I work hard enough and study this, I'll be able to figure it out. I know that in my own naivete, I thought when I started, not nearly as long ago as you did, I thought, well, what this topic needs is a good reporter. I'll dig into this, and 6 months I'll have it figured out. Now it's 25 or so years later, and I don't have any answers to anything. I know less than what I did then. Do you think that if you had enough cases, well, I guess I'll ask it this way, what kinds of questions could be answered with enough data and looking at the big picture?
So, you know, that is the first thing you do, you're supposed to do in science, but it has never been done with UFO data. And it's just, you know, forget the ideology. Let's not jump to conclusions that they come from here or there. Let's just make a list of what are the researchable issues. I mean, that's you know, rule number one in science. What is it that we can study? And you find that the good news is that you end up with a long list, but all of that we could do today. We don't need to presuppose an answer. We don't need to lobby the government. We don't need to do any of that. We have enough data to begin asking those questions. So there are six And my argument with the group in Paris was, we have six classes of questions. First, do we have global patterns in our data? Two, what are the physical facts of the phenomenon? Not just selected facts, you know, like it makes holes in the ground, or but what are all the physical facts? Are there special locations where it manifests? What are the social and cultural factors that affect the way it's reported, or, you know, the way we see things or don't see things? What's the impact on the witnesses? What's the impact on human beings? And what methodology do we have that is applicable to that, or do we need to invent a new methodology? So on patterns, the first question, you know, people talk about disclosure. Let's let the government disclose that UFOs are here. Well, if we did, there would be a lot of people who would start asking some questions, and we would be very embarrassed that we haven't done the research, which we could do. We could do it now. How long has the phenomenon manifested? When did it start? Most ufologists believe it starts with Kenneth Arnold, you know, in June 1947. Well, we have data from way before then, from the 19th century and from centuries before. Did we study that? No, we're certainly beginning to study that. Chris Obeck in Spain and I and a few others. But, you know, we are a long way from having the final answer. What patterns emerge from the data? Is there a pseudo-random model behind these events? In other words, is it like a teaching system? Is it like a training system? Does it suggest an interaction with humanity? Does it react to things we do? Are the waves? We have intense waves of sightings. You know, usually they last about 3 months over a particular part of the world. Are they cyclical? Can they be used to forecast where the next wave is going to take place? Can we go there with cameras or with radar or with instruments? Is it correlated with natural cycles? Is it correlated with astronomy, with physics, with biology, with, you know, some cycle we already know? And what are the relationships that emerge when we look at the witnesses? Is a phenomenon specifically designed for its own witnesses? In terms of physics, what are the various types of manifestations? I mean, these were not, you know, are not always presented as disks. There are orbs, there are lights, there are sounds, there are structured objects, there are unstructured phenomena. How do they present in combination? At the conference in Paris, there were several presentations by people who had studied the Hasdalen phenomenon. That is an area of the world, a little bit like the Utah Ranch, you know, that NIDS has been studying, that Mr. Bigelow has instrumented. In Hasdalen, lights and structured objects have been reported for the last 20 years. There are a number of observatories that have been built there by various universities in Europe to study these phenomena, and the results are very, very puzzling. So we are learning a lot about instrumentation, which was a big part of the discussion in Paris.
So
what can we measure?
Yes.
We can measure light output, we can measure energy, we can measure material composition, we can measure compass effects, magnetic remnants, radioactivity, all of that. That has never, I mean, good people have done studies like that, but it has never really been brought together.
Your call to arms, so to speak, did it catch on? I mean, was there enthusiasm there for
this? Yes, because there was a realization that all of that we can do today. You know, this is not like, you know, studying the Big Bang, where you need new theories, you need new instruments, you need to launch new satellites. These are things where we have the equipment to do all that, and we have the people who know how to use it. Now, later, we will need new hypotheses, new theories, new equipment, you know, with new science. But let's get the facts straight. I mean, what is it that's preventing us from doing it? We want to know, you know, how many cases involve impact on plant life, on insect life. When I was in Russia, actually, it was still the Soviet Union, when I was there in around 1990, there were a number of their scientists were studying UFO landing sites, gathering data about insects. Now, we've never done that in the U.S. That's an insect is a very interesting detector. That's something that can be done. How many microorganisms can be recruited as enhanced detectors or measuring devices at the site where an encounter has taken place? Well, another question that's challenging, why is there no good picture of a UFO?
Why not? What's your answer?
Well, I think the problem is not with our equipment. You know, today everybody has three cameras, you know, two of which are in your smartphone. The phenomenon shields itself in some ways we really don't understand. And I've talked to people who had designed equipment to study UFOs at special sites where they should have gotten good pictures. And they got either nothing or they got fuzzy pictures. I investigated a case in the suburb of Paris where a woman had seen a UFO drifting by her building. She lived on the 15th floor. I've been there. I've spoken to her. I've spoken to her neighbors. There was no question that thing was there. She took two pictures with a Kodak,
Instamatic.
An ordinary camera, film okay. camera. We looked at the film with experts from Hollywood, digitized it at great resolution. We could see lights in the distance. We could see headlights of cars. We couldn't see the object. The object wasn't there on the film. Okay, I'm convinced that she saw that and that it was there. Now that's obviously a puzzle. It's a challenge to people designing equipment. There are information-rich areas like the Bigelow Ranch, like Col de Vence, where I've been four times in the last 2 years, like Yakima Valley, like the Urals in Russia, like Hesdalen. What are the characteristics of those areas? Why is the phenomenon, you know, attracted to those areas, or why does it manifest there? It's not a question of geology. We've already excluded that. So what is it? Does the behavior of the phenomenon change when it's confronted with special measures, when it's confronted with the military, when it's confronted with new social conditions, during a war, for example? Does its behavior change when you put equipment there? Does it like to play with our equipment, as it seems to do?
Yes.
Does it like to play with our rockets? What could be expected from spatial observation programs in those spatial locations?
That's exciting. So all that stuff could be at least addressed to some degree with this coordinated worldwide database.
We have 200,000 cases from all over the world. I mean, it's not perfect. There is a lot of better screening to do, but we could start really looking at those questions with the equipment we already have today.
When we come back, we're going to go to a break here in a second. When we come back, I want to talk about what you need to get this done. I mean, do you need a sponsor, a government? What would it take to get this off the ground? And then also want to get into just the nature of the phenomena, because it doesn't always cooperate. It defies us. It confounds us. It sort of messes with our mind. The Utah Ranch is an example of it, where it kind of stays one step ahead. It morphs into different forms. It seems to know where we're heading and what we're doing. And that goes back to the learning curve that we were discussing earlier, how it's not just a matter of numbers and dots and data on a piece of paper, is it?
No, and, I do that. Obviously, it's a fascinating phenomenon in itself. But I do that because, you know, my business is high technology. So anything that can teach me something new about technology or about the limits of our technology, I'm interested in. I mean, it's my job.
Well, we'll take a break. Jacques Vallée is my guest. Much more stuff to come. This is pretty interesting, a new direction for ufology. We'll see how far it can go and what we need to get it off the ground right after this on Coast to Coast AM.